this or the next 2 months is people push their bonds in, but they really only have 5 out of 8 weeks to sell them. So we'll have a little supply-demand problem probably next 2 months. Which all goes to say, if you're thinking, when you think about sort of hedging, and as we get to where we talk about accelerating your bond issue, we're not saying try to accelerate to 2 weeks from now, because we expect we need to see a little bit of weakness going forward. But again, the main point is, when we look at where rates are here, the orange line is the 5.5% that you're projecting in the moving on rate plan between 2015 and 2023. We're close to that. So it's an appropriate time to be thinking about what to do and whether we want to take actions to hedge some of your risk. So when I think about hedging strategies for the tollway, I think there's sort of two ways to look at this. There's near term and there's long term. For the near term, and each one of these sort of has one major option that you can consider. For near term hedging, which is really 2014, you've got $500 million in March, $500 million in September, the option is to accelerate those bond issues, to simply borrow them early and to lock in the current market. Now there's a cost to that, which is what we call the cost of carry, which is a spread between whatever rate you lock in, whether it's 470, 480, 490, and the measly 5 basis points that you're going to invest those proceeds in for several months before they get spent. That's the cost of hedging on a near-term basis. On a long-term basis, your really only option is issuing derivatives and entering into interest rate swaps and things like that. We can't advance funds for years in advance. There's various reasons why you can't do that, but it's an impractical option in the long term. I think today what we really want to focus on in more detail is the near-term hedging, this issue of the 2014 bonds. We'd like to come back to you and talk to you more about longer-term hedging at some point in the future, whether it's discussion with the Finance Committee or the full board. We'd be happy to do either or both, depending on your level of interest and your desire to move forward with that option. But that requires a very deep dive. There's a lot of issues to be discussed there, and so we'll touch on them later, but we'd like to put that off to another session where we get into that more detail, assuming you want to move forward. So near-term hedging. As I mentioned earlier, the tollway currently has two issues planned for 2014. You have $450 million planned for March and $450 million planned for September. You can lock in today's interest rates by accelerating those deals and issuing a portion or all of them now or sometime in the near future. As I mentioned earlier, there's a cost to that. And the cost is you don't need the money today. So you're going to get the money, you're going to start paying interest on those bonds, you start incurring interest costs, and you're going to invest that money at a very low investment rate because we don't have better options today. That's with a steep yield curve. That's a little under $2 million a month is the cost to do that. So if we think about trying to take that March issue and pull it forward 4 months, you can do it in November, that would cost about $7.4 million present value. Or another way to think about it is to add about 6 basis points to the borrowing cost of the bonds. If we move the September issue forward 10 months to November, that would be about $18 million in present value cost. The benefits, I think, of doing this strategy are pretty clear. Rates go up. Between now and when you would have issued, you will not be paying those higher rates if you borrow early. And that's the real benefit. You lock in the lower rates. The disadvantages, you're paying the cost to carry. Now, there's a real cost there. If rates stayed the same, you would have incurred that cost for no benefit. If rates went lower, the cost is greater, of course. You lost an opportunity to borrow at a lower rate. The other risk is that the number is bigger than we think it is, even if rates stay the same. Right now, the projections are that you'll need the money. The idea about borrowing the money in March is you're going to be spending the money. We know you have the no pressure $1.4 billion going out next year. So not to be a Debbie Downer, but sometimes money doesn't go out the door as quickly as planned, and for many, many reasons. But it is possible that the spending will occur at what is planned. So for instance, we get to January and you realize you don't need the money in March. We really need the money in May. That's 2 more months. So if we'd issued in November, the cost wouldn't be $7.5 million, it really would be $11 million because we didn't borrow 4 months ahead, we actually borrowed 6 months ahead. So there's a little risk there that the costs are higher because we can't predict today exactly when that money's going to go out the door, and as construction changes, there'll be some adjustments. Hopefully those schedules are right, but those kind of things are always subject to change. The concept of advanced funding is also somewhat limited by practical realities. There are tax laws we have to deal with. You do have to have a reasonable expectation when you borrow money ahead that you're going to spend that money within 3 years. That's a requirement of issuing tax-exempt debt. So you can't sort of say, hey, I'm going to do 2014, I'm going to do 2015, I'm going to do a whole bunch, because you may not be able to plan to get that money out the door, and your bond council will put a stop to whatever is not reasonable. And there's also just a practical reality of you don't really want to have, I think, $2 or $3 billion sitting unspent in your bond funds. It's a lot of money, and it raises a lot of questions as to why you have that much money, and most issuers don't like facing those questions. So that could be a little uncomfortable, and I think there's a real practical reason to sort of avoid doing that. So when we think about, you know, balancing this, the benefit of locking in lower rates and these costs, one thing that we think it makes sense to consider is not the concept of rushing into the market to try to lock in today's rates. As I said, I feel like we may have some, you know, a little pressure on the market in the next couple of months. But I think it's worth very seriously considering getting ready to go in the market early. So maybe being ready to go in January, being ready to go in February, getting your underwriting team involved, doing all the steps we need to do to get a bond deal ready, so that if you feel at that time that rates are favorable, if you feel like, and you'll have more visibility at that time, by the way. When you get to January, you're 2 months closer to March, so you'll know if March is really the time you would have needed to do the bonds, or if it's now May or June or some other time. You have much better visibility to your plan as you get closer to spending those dollars. You'll be better prepared to make a decision at that point as to whether you really want to issue early and accelerate these bond issues. So being prepared is almost a cost-free endeavor. You get the team geared up, and if you get to February, March, you know, January, February, March, and you don't want to accelerate the deals, you just don't do it. You just wait and do it according to the original schedule.
Do you mind if we just pause there, since this is really the question that we wanted to, mm-hmm. in particular, get some kind of guidance on and discussion around. So I think that when we're talking about having, you know, kind of a strategic approach here, I think one question that we had for the board is, you know, what is the threshold of tolerance for, you know, some carrying costs in the near term, but, you know, obviously then you're balancing potentially getting in the long term a lower percentage borrowing rate or the assurance of at least what the borrowing rate would be, mm-hmm. then, you know, kind of an uncertain environment later next year where, you know, the rate could be higher. So I wanted to kind of pose that question, right? The risk-benefit analysis.
I want to follow up on that. Do we need to do, like, the March issue with the September issue combined by $900 million?
Mm-hmm.
What are the upside downsides of doing, instead of doing all $400 million in the next, you know, 6 to 8 weeks, versus doing $100 million and doing that over several months? What are the pluses and minuses of that? You're kind of hedging, but you're not all in.
Dollar cost averaging strategy.
Right, exactly. So how does that work?
You could do that. I hadn't actually thought about that particular option. The simplest downside, I would say, is it's just a lot of staff time to be doing a bond deal every single month. It's going to be somewhat a drag on staff time, and it will be hard to manage from that. It's not the most unwieldy thing in the world, though. And that is very much a strategy like dollar cost averaging with investing, which is you're not trying to time the market. You're going to sort of you're going to slowly enter the market. You're going to get into the market at different times and in different environments and experience different rates. Because you've done an acceleration strategy, we think that will be lower costs because we do think rates are going up. So if you accelerate over the year, I think that would be definitely lower interest costs. You might have some higher execution costs, but they would, you know, the lawyers and things like that, it's going to be, those numbers won't be terribly impactful.
But there will be some higher cost and fees.
Oh, yeah, I think, yes, yeah. The underwriting fees don't change because those are on a per bond basis, but you will have to have every issue, a closing, a new disclosure document, opinions from the attorneys, and I think that's probably the issue more than anything. Is even if you barely had to change the documents every other month, you're asking the attorney to keep issue opinions and stuff, so they're going to really have to charge, you know, for each one of those.
Is that more attractive to buyers or not as attractive when you're doing a smaller?
I think it's, it may be a little bit less attractive to buyers because one of the things that buyers tend to like is they like to see a big security that they view as very liquid and very tradable. So when you issue, you know, say $400 or $500 million at a time, you're going to amortize some of that and have some smaller, what we call serial bonds that will be due in, you know, 19, 20, 21 years. But you're going to put the majority of it into a bond at the long end, and it may be a term bond that matures in 25 years and it might have sinking fund payments in 23 years, 24. But it'll be a big bond. It'll be $300 million or so. And buyers really like that. You know, that's a big tradable piece of paper that they find very appealing. So you might lose a couple basis points if you break it up into smaller pieces and that the bonds are just a little bit less appealing to the big investors. And we're, in Illinois, we're not a direct retail state because there's no state tax exemption. We don't get individual buyers, you know, smaller retail buyers who are interested in our bonds. In states where there's a state tax exemption, you get a lot more retail interest. So sometimes the small pieces do really well there because there's demand for smaller pieces. But we're really going to see something much more to your bigger institutional investors. And they're not worried. They like size, as big size as opposed to something smaller.
Can you speak up?
Sure. So if I could just add to that comment, Jill, I don't think a series of nine $100 million transactions would probably be beneficial to us, but certainly consideration of should we do $300 million transactions or possibly four transactions. You still need a certain amount of size in the deal to get the kind of investor interest that we're trying to attract. And I think Jill spoke to that.
I mean, one good thing is you've actually kind of implemented that strategy in a way already in that you had a new money deal in May and then you had a little refunding deal in July. You have another refunding deal much shorter on the curve. It's not very long maturities, but that's scheduled at this point for November. So then if you pick this deal up in the spring, you've kind of bought like four different markets over the space of a year, which I think gets to that strategy somewhat as well.
Just to be clear, I don't think we want the board to be deciding anything at this board meeting. I think what we do want is to hear your judgment, your opinions, and any questions you have about this, and then the financial team will go back and really
and crunch the numbers and maybe get, you know, the decision is that, you know, there would be some tolerance to, you know, issue bonds a little bit in advance and absorb some carrying costs, but with, you know, obviously greater certainty around, you know, an interest rate, the interest rate environment, you know, if that is acceptable, then we can go back and start getting teams ready and you know, start watching the market to time an issuance a little earlier than we were originally contemplating.
Do you foresee the recent politics in Washington retarding the Fed's ability to maybe unwind as soon as they want to, maybe delaying this uptick in interest rates in the spring?
I don't think that politics in Washington will affect that so much as...
More the damage that was done to the economy. The underlying damage that's been done to the economy because of the recent politics.
Yes. The softening of the economy has already pushed sort of this back to what might have been earlier in the year to, you know, already sort of the end of the first quarter. At least that's the expectation. If the economy continues to soften, yes, I think they will push back. The Fed has really, all indications are that they have been very, very committed to trying to use the management of interest rates as a tool to help fuel the economy, and I do not think that strategy is going to change. So the more softening we see, the more likely they're going to continue to use. Their appetite for balance sheet appears to be unlimited. It's hard to wrap your mind around. The Fed used to have about $750 billion of securities on its balance sheet. Right now it has over $3.6 trillion. When I say used to, that's pre-financial crisis, 5 years ago. mean, it's really amazing, the growth. And $85 million a month is a tremendous amount of purchasing every single month, adding that to the balance sheet. So I think 2 or 3 years ago, it would have been hard for us to imagine they'd be buying at this pace. But at this point, I think they will keep doing it if they need to. So it definitely could lead to that pushing off. So yes, very hard to predict what's going to happen with interest rates because of these dynamics.
But you did, I just really, so the benefit obviously of locking in the current rate, but earlier you did mention that you anticipate at some point they will uptick.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And around, I mean, is there, what was the time frame?
So it's hard to say with precision, and I will tell you that, you know, as a firm, we don't make forecasts or predictions that we publish. We do internally believe that we're going to see rates, for instance, we think that, you know, the 10-year, which is around 250 right now, will be in the 3 to 3.25 range in a year from now. We don't have a point of view as to when it's going to happen, but we do think that over the next year we're going to see that. We think that the 10-year will get to 4% probably within a couple of years. So we do believe rates will go up. The softness of the economy may push that a little.
How much more work can you handle, Bob?
With the discount that you're fighting in the bids, it's almost balances out on the cost of the financing of the money.
And that argues for putting many, many more bids out right now, right?
Yes.
I think it's a really important point, though, and one that, you know, it's easy for me in my world to focus on the cost of borrowing, but the cost of borrowing is just a piece in this plan. You have a lot of other factors, and the cost of construction is really the single biggest one. And so there is that, you know, if the construction bids have been coming in lower, as they have been, and you continue to expect them to, then you can think about, well, can I have a little bit more risk in my financial plan? So these are things that are important to balance when you think about all of this is, you know, how much you need to hedge is really determined by how tight your budget is, how hard is it if you break through this part of the budget. You have other places where you're under. In addition, you're a very healthy agency financially, so you can manage through if you don't hit your budget. But it doesn't mean that you don't want to sort of prudently think about this and have a good strategy going forward.
So when you think about, you mentioned, you know, the cost, the carrying cost of being $2 million, potentially $2 million a month,
mm-hmm.
right? But 1/100th of a basis point being $5 million doesn't take too sophisticated math to start to look at those numbers and say, you know, that's not very much of an increase in our cost of borrowing, and that's, you know, 2.5 months
mm-hmm.
of cost of carry, right? Am I
right.
doing the math correctly?
Right, when you think about
it. My advanced degree in mathematics.
I think you showed a slide earlier, about six basis points, right?
It is, it's right up here. Yes. The cost for this particular issue is about 6 basis points. The one, when you think about the 9 years, it's very impactful. And that's where having some type of longer-term derivative strategy might be a good idea, because you're very exposed over that 9-year period. And we looked at that slide we had earlier. Rates have been a lot higher. We're still in a very good interest rate environment, but it's not that long ago when rates were, you know, substantially over that 5.5% line. So these are not, while there was more cushion when that plan was put together, when the Move Illinois plan was first put together, there was more cushion than there is now. I mean, we can see realistically that there is definitely there's definitely some risk that rates will be higher. It's not like it hasn't happened and it could happen. Do you want to talk for a couple minutes about? Go ahead.
Yeah.
To truly
take advantage of this, I think Director Sweeney's point was a good one. Would we be in a position if we accelerated this to accelerate construction project sites? I mean, I understand the benefits to it, as Christy pointed out. However, you were taking this thing in its entirety and you really wanted to maximize the benefit of this. It seems to me like we've been pretty aggressive in the way we've laid this out so far, so I'm just wondering whether or not that's even an option. realistically.
Yeah, that, and Director Sweeney and Director Rowe, that it took me like 5 minutes to recover from that question. I really am thinking hard about it.
I was waiting until I saw color again.
It did go away.
And I realized, and I was thinking the same thing. It's like, get everything in there now. Get as much as we can. We know we're going to be pushing ourselves big time next year. I think we are being super aggressive, more doubling what we're doing this year. So I would love to have a year to answer this question, but I realize, you know, it means you need the answer now to really take advantage of things. And, I mean, I would have to tell you that, you know, I am excited about the opportunity of getting this work out there, but I won't tell you that there's a great amount of ability to add on to it. There are a few project areas where I know we have the design work. And, you know, the design always happens like the year before the construction. So I know there are a few areas where we could probably expedite design efforts to try to get a little bit more out there, but probably not enough to make a big difference, and I would definitely like to see how we perform with the 1.4 first.
Well, we are in the construction industry seeing a recovery in the man hours work to the point where very quickly, I would say in the next year and a half, you're going to start to see the pushback then on the bid side.
Yeah.
And I mean, because it's there. I mean, we've got some other major projects in the area that are starting on the utility sides with People's Gas, Nicor, AT&T, and ComEd Smart Grid, and that's going to have inflationary pressures that, you know, there's a window here and it's not going to be here for long, I don't think. Well, if something happens,
I think the good thing, though, is that, you know, when we set up the program, we anticipated some of this inflationary pressure, and we kind of laid it out in what we thought was the best manner in which to allow the industry to adapt to the demand that we were going to be placing on them and still not go totally crazy on the cost of things or push us to the point where now we're just managing too much more work than we actually are set up to handle.
You see more national firms coming in. We've had a few come in to the market that have never been here before, the Lane Constructions, people like that in the world, coming in maybe keeping a lid on that for a little bit longer as they try to establish themselves.
Yeah, I think that is a very positive sign, you know, that at least we're getting more players in the game, and that can only be helpful to us.
How many of those players have super unlimited capacity at $300
million? I think this one that was mentioned, you know, does.
A couple of them definitely do. It's surprising who's coming into the market.
And the more, you know, the competition will help. Will help postpone that increase.
I just wanted to explore the other end of that question. As was indicated, if we accelerate the bond purchases, or the bond sales, you know, we have 3 years in which to use the dollars. Is it safe to assume, in your opinion, that we wouldn't have any trouble in that, in expending it within that time frame?
Our analysis in terms of next year's schedule is $1.4 billion. The year after that, I think it's still $1 billion or more. So we don't see an issue with, you know, with this type of approach.
You've got a good comfort level.
Yeah.
Is it actually the spend or the commitment through a contract that triggers it?
It's the actual spend.
If you don't spend it by 3 years, you lose those bonds, lose it, their tax exempt status. Is that what happens with the risk?
That's kind of the worst case scenario.
It really is contingent on what was your reasonable expectation when you issued the bonds. So long as you had a reasonable expectation at the time you issued the bonds that you would spend that money within 3 years, there should be no issue if, in fact, you do not spend the money.
That's what Mike just said. There's a reasonable expectation.
That's it.
That's what I thought I heard.
Yeah, I think you hit the scale.
I get to answer all the questions.
Right. Other comments or questions on this?
So we did want to...
let's just pause, I'm sorry, for one more moment on this. So I think if I could summarize, what I'm hearing is you would like the staff and the financial advisor to go back and think about this a little bit more, think about the options that have been laid out here, which isn't necessarily, and Director Peterson's suggestion that there's even another option, which I think got a lot of support, but maybe something in between where we had been thinking and where we are now. And am I also hearing that it does make sense to be prepared to go into the market and have that as sort of our fundamental goal, is that we lay the options out but make sure that we're at a point where we really are prepared when the opportunities come up. Is that a fair summary of what I'm hearing? Christy, does that sound right?
That sounds good. What we'll do then is get teams working so that we can be prepared to maybe go a little earlier, but we'll keep you posted and come back with
think about the when and how much and you know, just to the extent we can lay out the risks and the costs on the option.
One other question. When it does start to occur, the uptick again on interest, we don't see it spiking when it does it. More of a gradual run-up, not maybe not traditional.
We think it may be a little more gradual than what happened this spring and summer. But, you know, it's hard to say. Investors are not
rational.
When you think about the market, it's all supposed to be rational, but it's not. And so it's hard to predict behavior. The tapering announcement previously was so unexpected that it really, we think, generated oversell-off in the market.
And by the way, the University of Chicago cleans up on the Nobel Prizes on precisely this point. One year the market is rational, the next year they get it, the market's not rational.
I used to have one of those shirts that had all the USC Nobel laureates listed on one shirt. It was just, you know, this huge long list. It's old. I need to update it. It's a longer. You need to get a new shirt, longer list now. This was really dramatic, this sell-off here, and really took the market participants by surprise. We think that was really the market was oversold. It was a very severe overreaction. The market now knows that, okay, we've really been told tapering is going to happen, and we have a pretty good sense of when it's going to happen. And I don't think the Fed will accelerate that. I think that would have a real shock to the market. I don't think they want to do that. They probably were surprised by what happened the last time. So if anything, they'll delay a little bit. But the market's had a lot more time to digest this, so I think the reaction will be a little more muted and a little bit more steady. But, you know, if China says that they've really had it with the U.S. and they don't want to own, you know, treasuries anymore, then that's the kind of thing that, the rest of it won't matter, you know, because, if they start selling, we're going to have a real problem because we'll have too much supply in the market. So we're always exposed to those kind of risks that we don't really know. Our interest rates are really tied to what goes on in the rest of the world because there's so much demand for U.S. Treasury securities around the world. So it's a little fickle, and we're somewhat tied to what's going on in other places that we can't predict.
Okay, thank you. Now we'll finally let you get to the floor.
So this, I think we just want to touch on briefly, and this is more of a things to think about in the future. As I mentioned earlier, if to the extent that the board is interested in doing, you know, a longer-term hedging program, we want to come back and spend more time really getting into the detailed options of how you actually execute that, what are the structures, and what are the risks associated with those. Again, derivatives allow you to sort of lock in some of your interest rates in the future. They don't allow you to lock them in a precise way where you can say exactly what your borrowing rate is going to be in the future, but they do allow you to sort of cap your exposure to interest rate risk. So you're really sort of hedging total market movement as opposed to saying, you know, I'm going to now be able to borrow at 5.125%. So they're quite effective at hedging overall market risk, but again, it's not a precise instrument. There's two main ways that you can enter into derivatives. One is a forward-starting swap. This would be a similar product to what you've used in the past, and you have a number of them currently on your books right now. When you do a forward-starting swap, you enter into a derivative contract that has no cash flows or payments up front. It starts at some point in the future. And so at some point in the future, you will have to settle that swap, and it would be tied to when you expect to issue bonds. And you would either settle that swap by actually entering into it, issuing variable rate bonds, entering into the swap, and having what we call synthetic fixed rate, or you would terminate the swap at that point and exchange payments. And the way that would work is if interest rates are higher, which is what you're hedging against, you would get a payment. So if you got a payment for $50 million at some point when interest rates are higher, you now have proceeds already in hand. You don't have to issue as much bonds. So you're issuing less bonds in a higher interest rate environment, and that's how your total cost of capital is lower. Now, if interest rates have gone down, you're going to make a payment if you want to terminate. So your interest rates, are they going to be effectively what they were like when you entered into the swap? Because you make a payment, you've already spent proceeds, and then you issue bonds. So now you're issuing more bonds in a lower interest rate environment. So you didn't benefit from rates going down. You sort of stayed at the same level approximately. And that is actually approximately the same level plus a little cost is really what it is. But if they're higher, you're going to benefit. But the main thing to think about with these is you're dealing with it in the future. You do the contract today, there's going to be a settlement and a cost in the future. The other option is to do something called a swaption, which is you buy an option up front to enter into a swap in the future. And in this case, you incur the expenses today. You then have an option to enter in a swap, and if rates are higher, you will enter or terminate that swap, so you'll make it go live, or you'll get a payment back. You'll say, I want to enter into it and terminate it the same day, so you'll just take a check. If interest rates are lower, you just let the option expire. No cost in the future. You incur the cost up front. So you pay for interest rate protection. If rates are down, fine. You issue at lower rates, that's good, but you pay the cost up front. So they're kind of, it's all about when you incur the costs. And those are the sort of two main products. Now, any derivative transaction carries its own set of risks. So you're minimizing your risks on your capital borrowing plan, but you're incurring some other risks, which is you have exposure to a counterparty, you're in this big contract, if things go south, you may have to terminate it, maybe because your counterparty's credit declines, and at a time when you didn't want to, which means you could incur costs, and sometimes you didn't. Various things like that. The financials may not work out exactly as you like. There's something called basis risk involved. So there's a whole bunch of risks associated with it that you'll have to think about whether you want to do that. So you hedge a big risk, but then you take on some other risks in doing so. The last piece we just want to briefly touch on, something to sort of noodle on and think about, is there's one other way to hedge long-term. You can't do this for a lot of your borrowing, but you could use the federal government's TIFIA loan program to hedge a portion of your borrowing costs. And the way that this really works is that the TIFIA program, which is run by the federal DOT, allows borrowers to fund up to a third. The new program says up to 50% of your costs, but in practical reality, you're not approving anybody for that. It's really up to a third of your costs on a project through a TIFIA loan, which is at the federal government's borrowing rate. So right now, it's around 3.6%, very low rate. And there's a lot of flexibility in the program. So you could, if you use the TIFIA program, you'd have to define a project, max 30% could be TIFIA. You could enter into the loan agreement. When you enter into the loan agreement, you lock the rate at that time. But you don't actually have to draw on it until you're very far into your project, and even after project completion. So you could fund it in the interim with other sources of funding. You could issue your bond, and if rates are going up, you lock that one rate. And you lock it with no cost to carry, because you don't draw on the loan until you actually spend it. So it's a really nice product to do a little bit of hedging, but it's going to be limited in size and what you can do. And you take on some other hassle factor, which is you don't deal right now with federal money. So if you decide to go down this path, you have to you accept all the hassles that come with federal money, Buy America, and various other provisions that they have.
So, as you may recall, the board did approve a team, underwriter team, a team to work on potentially an issue that would involve TIFIA, right?
Right.
TIFIA. So this is something that we do want to get into a little bit more. I don't mean to rush us along too much, but we do have one more presentation to get to before we get to the agenda. So I think that our goal was to at least tee some of these up so that you can all, of course, rush back to your offices to Google all of these terms and become financial experts before our next discussion. But we'll also try to make sure you have the right materials in advance to have productive discussions, probably in the Finance Committee, digging into these a little bit more deeply as strategies. So
we'll give to the Finance Committee the next step. And we don't have to talk about those here.
Yeah, no, we don't need to go into this. I think the real takeaway for us is that know, we'll work with staff on thinking about a strategy for how much to hedge, whether you should have a target interest rate, those kind of things, and develop those type of recommendations that we'll then get back to the board.
Thank you.
Great,
thanks.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. So as if there hadn't been enough meaty topics to discuss, we now have one more presentation. Mike Stone has been working on this for the past little over a month with several others here from the tolling, including John Benda. We're going to talk a little bit about potential speed limit increase on the tollway system. As you all may know, some legislation was passed and signed into law earlier this year that raised the maximum allowable speed limit on interstates in the state to as much as 70 miles per hour. We're going to talk to you a little bit about how the tollway currently intends to potentially implement that change, the process we need to go through, and I'm going to turn it over to Mike to do that.
Thank you, Christy. Exciting to follow that exciting hedging discussion. As Christy mentioned, we are there's a new law that Governor Cuomo signed on August 19th that allows the maximum speed limit on Illinois interstate highways to go up to a maximum of 70 miles per hour outside of urban districts. So it's limited in terms of scope. It has to be a highway that is outside an urban district. The law applies to both the Illinois tollway and IDOT, and IDOT is going through its process for implementation in 2014. And for the tollway, our process is a little different. We have to comply with certain procedural requirements before we can actually increase our speed limit. These procedural process is the same that we went through in other situations. For example, when we increased the speed limit from 55 miles per hour to 65 miles per hour on I-355 from I-55 to I-80. So our process is different than IDOT's. We must satisfy these procedural requirements before we can increase the speed limit. The process begins with the tollway's Traffic Operations Safety Committee, which considers the proposal to increase the speed limit and then commissions an engineering traffic study to study the issue, our engineering traffic study being CDM Smith. After completion of the study, and if the tollway board endorses the recommendation from the speed limit study, the rule change would then go to the Joint Committee on Administrative Rules, or JCAR. And after, in our case, concurrently, we would seek a concurrence from IDOT for the increase. And after JCAR approves the increase through its process, the Secretary of State will publish the rule change, and the tollway will update the speed limit change through posting of new signage on its tollway. So we have now completed our speed limit study on the areas outside of urban districts or rural areas. This map generally shows where those proposed speed limit increases would be. Along the Jane Addams in the upper left-hand corner, we would recommend an increase west of the I-39 interchange at milepost 17.4, go up to 70 miles per hour. That's about approximately a 15-mile stretch along I-90. On the Ronald Reagan I-88 in the lower left-hand corner, we recommend an increase in the speed limit of 270 miles per hour west of Route 47 at milepost 109. That's approximately a 64-mile stretch. With respect to that little blue section up on I-94, we would recommend a conditional increase. We would post it at 65 miles per hour currently from north of Stearns Road, Stearns School Road at milepost 7.0 to the terminus. Wisconsin is actually considering similar legislation to Illinois' legislation currently to increase the max.